Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking that they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. In the antebellum South, there were two kinds of secrets, the well-kept ones and the ones that were regularly brought into the light of day to be gossiped over, but never in front of the wrong people. One of the most enduring of the latter had to do with a ship, a treacherous voyage, and a bet, which sounds romantic, but is anything but. The story goes that some men got to drinking one cool and damp November night while on a steamboat that was churning its way through the bayous around Mobile. It was 1859, and the likelihood of an upcoming showdown between the southern states and the northern ones about the defensibility of slavery was on everyone's tongue. You know this, of course, but humor me a very brief, overly simplistic Cliff's Notes on history. The North thought slavery was a moral catastrophe and an embarrassment on the world stage. The South thought, accurately, that it was the foundation of their entire economy. But don't be confused. They didn't consider it a necessary evil. They liked it. It worked for them. And they viewed the upcoming war as a personal affront to their dignity and pride. Who were those other people to tell them what to do with their money and their land? The Gaul. The hated intervention into the Southern way of life had begun in 1808 when the feds made it illegal for anyone to bring human cargo onto its shores for the purpose of buying and selling them into slave labor. To add insult to injury, they had made doing so an act of piracy and a hanging offense. It was a direct challenge to Southern manhood. So back to the story of the steamboat, which, to be clear, I call a story because there's no documentary evidence proving this part of the tale is true, that the men drinking aboard railed against the injustice. They pondered what could be done to show the North that the South wouldn't stand for such an insult. That supposedly when 47-year-old Timothy Mayer stood up and said, more or less, "Screw them, I'm gonna get me a boat and I'm gonna go to Africa and I'm gonna bring back men and women and I'm gonna enslave them. Watch me." The story has it that someone on board said it couldn't be done. And Mayer said, "Wanna bet?" His decision would make history in the most awful of ways. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Home Chef.
I checked our bank account to see how much we'd spent eating out last month, and it was a little embarrassing.
Well, we were out of town for a bit. Now that we're back, we get to rely on Home Chef, which is always such a relief. Fresh food delivered, easy recipes, and the meals genuinely taste great. No long shopping lists, no complicated prep, and the cleanup is so minimal, it almost feels like cheating.
And it's not like you're locked in the one type of meal.
Not at all. Whether you need a 30-minute meal, an oven-ready tray, or even a quick microwave lunch, Home Chef has you covered. Over 30 meal options each week with choices for different tastes and dietary needs.
Home Chef is rated number one by users of other meal kits for quality, convenience, value, taste, and recipe ease. And customers save an average of $86 a month on groceries.
For a limited time, Home Chef is offering our listeners 50% off and free shipping on your first box, plus free dessert for life. Go to homechef.com/COTC.
That's homechef.com/COTC for 50% off your first box and free dessert for life. Homechef.com/COTC. Must be an active subscriber to receive free dessert.
Timothy Mayer was a self-made man who hated being told what to do. He had come up the hard way and now owned a lot of Alabama acreage, a sawmill, a boatyard, and cotton fields that ran across the Mid-South. The crime he had decided to commit was going to be expensive. He knew that. But if it worked, it would stick it to the feds. And besides, it could be fun. First, Mayer hired Captain William Foster to reconfigure one of his ships for the express purpose of running slaves from Africa to Alabama. An experienced privateer, Foster was, as one author put it, morally flexible enough to take on the job. He was familiar with the practice of bringing captives to Cuba for that purpose, and he knew the right people to talk to and the right port to sail into to get the job done. Per folklore, the bed aboard the steamboat had originally been made for $1,000, which was a hefty, 40 grand or more today. That kind of confidence convinced some other wealthy Mobile landowners to join in on the escapade. Their money helped to fund the trip and the purchases to be made once the ship got to the shores of West Africa. The plot was far from easy, and if caught, did not bode well for the conspirators. They all knew that the English Navy was helping to patrol the coasts off southern states for ships carrying human contraband, and that the federal government had officers on the boatyard docks watching what Captain Foster did. What he was doing was outfitting the Clotilda, a two-mast, fast-running schooner, turning its 23-foot wide by 86-foot long hull into a prison capable of holding 110 souls, the men horizontally housed on bookshelf-like planks that allowed for only 18-inch clearance between them. Those could handle three men, shackled by their feet, side by side for the voyage. The women were also to be chained at times, but would be allowed a bit more mobility, though the hull, floor to ceiling, measured a scant 5 feet, which required many to stoop throughout the ocean crossing. Children would also likely be part of the cargo. The hull enclosure allowed for a single opening at the hatch, so it was to remain, for the most part, dark as night inside the hold. The captives would be expected to eat and lay where they also urinated, defecated, vomited, and menstruated. I'm thinking calling Foster merely morally flexible is shortchanging him a bit. Morally bereft might be a tad closer. Now, as with every story, there are at least two points of view to take into account. The first, in this case, was told through the journal entries made by Foster and later uncovered in historical documents housed at the Mobile Public Library. The captive's memories of the voyage would be told to cultural anthropologist and ethnographer Zora Neale Hurston when she interviewed some of those still alive in the late 1920s through 1930. We know that Foster set sail in early spring 1860 from Mobile with 12 armed crewmen. That included a Portuguese translator and a discredited doctor who would be responsible for keeping the captives looking good enough to be worth Mayer's trouble when they arrived. The rest of the crew were chosen for their discretion or their willingness to relocate immediately after the voyage was complete. Their destination was the Kingdom of Dahomey in what is now Benin. It's considered the birthplace of voodoo. Vodun is its national religion. In 1860, it was an incredibly wealthy region ruled by King Lele, whose reign had developed a fast trade in palm oil with the rest of the world and, not uncoincidentally, with the international slave trade, which drew its cargo from the thousands imprisoned by the king's troops for just that purpose. The king, knowing that foreigners paid in gold and guns, regularly raided villages and surrounding city-states to march sometimes hundreds of miles back to the town of Ouida, located on the coast, for temporary installment in fortresses called barracoons. There, they waited to be sent to places they had never even heard of. Dr. Natalie Robertson, associate professor of history at Hampton University, spent 30 years investigating the case of the Clotilda. She spoke to National Geographic in their series, Shipwrecks of America.
The buyers, like Captain Foster, would arrive there in Ouida and negotiate sales for Africans through a series of appointed officials.
The language differences and likely bribes along the way made for tricky, but not always unpleasant, arrangements. This is from Foster's journey, voiced by an actor.
Arrived at Ouida May 15th. Having gotten ashore safely, I met with interpreters who gave me charge of three natives who put me in a hammock with canopy and carried me into the city of Ouida, 6 miles distant. Upon arrival, I found splendid accommodations. I went to see the king of Dahomey. We went to the warehouse where they had in confinement 4,000 captives in a state of nudity, from which they gave me liberty to select 125 as mine, for which I agreed to pay $100 per head.
The captives from which Foster had his pick were of various tribes, the Yoruba, the Fon, the Hausa, the Igbo, which meant that they spoke different languages, had different customs, and were differently tattooed or traditionally scarred and worshipped different gods. In a word, they were strangers to Foster, as well as strangers to, and maybe even enemies of, each other. But early on, a few of their number realized the stakes. If they were going to survive this, whatever this was, they were going to have to learn to communicate. More than that, they were going to have to make a concerted effort to remember not only each other's names, but every story and song and ritual they could from their own upbringings. They had to remember their parents and grandparents and the very life they had enjoyed in Africa. Packed into the darkened lower bowels of the two-masted schooner, they spent the hottest days of summer traveling west, then northerly across the Atlantic, for the 7,000-mile trek from their equatorial home to the shores of Alabama. None had ever been to sea. Hell, most had never even seen the ocean before they set sail on it. Now, like many before me, I fail to find words to describe what they endured. It is genuinely unfathomable. The History Channel, in a segment entitled Life on a Slave Ship, tried.
They were segregated by gender and age. Adult men were kept separately and shackled in pairs. Women usually left unbound in their designated compartment, and children often free to move about the ship. There was no plumbing of any kind. Slaves were forced to relieve themselves where they sat, creating hellish conditions when combined with the heat and lack of ventilation below deck. Disease was rampant. Measles, smallpox, influenza, scurvy, and dysentery, the number one killer, ravaged slaves and crew members alike.
Deep inside the Clotilda, Mayer's cargo sat and writhed in darkness, chained to the slated benches, unable to move. They were given a little water twice a day and fed just enough to keep them alive. It wasn't long, of course, before they were awash in their own waste and bilge. The dark, the smell, and the fear were inescapable. But they could try to listen to one another's languages and learn them. They could sing funeral songs for themselves, and they could invent other songs to teach them each other's names and each other's stories. Home was all they had to hold on to. It didn't save them from sorrow, but it did give them purpose. It gave them will. They very seldom had a chance to exercise it. Here's Dr. Robertson, editor of African American History and Transatlantic Perspective, again.
Typically, they would allow Africans to come up to exercise their limbs or take on some fresh air. But they wouldn't allow them to stay on deck for long periods of time. They would keep them shackled below deck.
As bad as it was, things on the Clotilda soon got worse. The ship encountered rough seas, a hurricane, and the death of several captives who died from the conditions or were washed overboard after being lashed to the masts for ballast. According to Matthew Harrison Clark, author of The Clotilda Conspiracy, the captives planned a mutiny, which failed. Three who had taken part were hanged from the yardarm for the others to see what kind of cruelty their captors were capable of. In their midst was 19-year-old Ulule Kosola, a young man from the Yoruba tribe and from a farming family who was being trained as a warrior. His village had been attacked in a pre-dawn raid staged by the feared Amazon women warriors of King Glele. The raid's purpose, according to historian Sylvian Diouf, was to collect more slaves for the king to sell to European, Asian, and, in this case, American buyers. Now, brief aside here, the Dahomey Amazons, named after the Amazons of Greek mythology, were introduced into the region's military ranks when the male ranks became diminished from constant warring. It's been suggested that they were championed by a previous king's twin sister who insisted that women could do the hard work of conquest as well as the men. I guess that should warm me as a feminist, but I'm not sure that it does. In any case, Kasolo, who would soon be known in America as Kazula or Kaju Lewis, was a particularly conscientious soul. He took the lead while on the ship, making each of the captives promise to try to stay in contact as best they could when they landed. Kasola made them recite the names of all on the ship and to create a rolling liturgy of stories that reminded them of their home. He made them promise to repeat them to each other and to their children and to their children's children, to imprint all they had known onto their very DNA. He also told himself that his own descendants must know the truth, that he was the second child of his mother who was one of his father's three wives, that they lived in the Isha subgroup of the Yoruba people of West Africa, and that it was his own countrymen who had sold him first. Kasolo's name, quite poetically, is translated to, "My children do not die anymore." The stories he made the others repeat were important to him and to them. They were the only solace they could extract from their capture. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Bull and Branch. I have spent so many years prioritizing everybody else, the kiddo, work, more work, that I never thought hard enough about my own sleep. But lately, I've realized how much it actually affects everything. My energy, my mood, my focus.
So you finally did something about it.
I did. Our old sheets had gotten thin and kind of scratchy, and I didn't even clock how much that was bothering me until I upgraded our whole bed with Boll & Branch. These sheets were seriously love at first sleep. The signature organic cotton sheets are unbelievably soft, and I love the waffle blanket too. And the whole bed just feels finished now.
I felt the quality the second I got in the bed. And they make the whole setup. Pillows, blankets, comforters, all designed to be breathable and to actually get better over time. It's the kind of upgrade you stop putting off once you realize how much it matters.
Sleep cooler this summer with Boll & Branch during their annual summer event. For a limited time, get 20% off site-wide at bollandbranch.com/COTC with code COTC. That's Boll & Branch, bollandbranch.com/COTC, code COTC to take 20% off. bollandbranch.com/COTC, code COTC. Exclusions apply. By the time the Clotilda entered the Gulf of Mexico, author Clark estimates that 17 of the 110 who had boarded the ship had died and been tossed into the Atlantic without clothes or ceremony. Some loss was always expected. In the 500-plus years of the transatlantic slave trade, historians estimate that at least 2 million Africans died en route. So there were 93 on board when Captain Foster spotted the Alabama coast on July 8, 1860. Mayer's bet was almost won. To clinch it, he would need to get the Africans off that boat and into the safe hands of friends who could hide their origin. But Mayer had thought it all through and had made plans with Foster and a few other cohorts, one of them a local judge, before the Clotilda had even sailed. They would have the Clotilda come into Mobile Bay on a night without a visible moon and during slack tide, that small portal of time when the water stills as it readies to change from ebb to flow. On shore, just before 11 p.m. on the 8th, a signal was given to set a large fire on the eastern shore of the bay as a diversion. Word on the street was that federal patrols had heard rumors of some sort of incoming slave ship. That was when, without lights or sail, the Clotilda maneuvered into a pre-selected channel off the Spanish River, somewhere the feds might not think to go, to be met by two steamboats. Timothy Mayer helmed one steamboat, and his brother James captained the other. They met Foster in almost complete silence and began to offload the Africans, tied together in small groups, onto the smaller boats. From there, the captives were sailed further into the Delta to be taken onto land and stashed in a forgotten barn on the property of one of Mayer's friends, only to be parceled out in coming days after the heat had died down. Mayer had given explicit orders for Captain Foster to take the Clotilda up the Mobile River and set her on fire. Foster had brought along kerosene for the task. When he sailed to an obscure spot near 12 Mile Island, he soaked the ship completely and set it aflame. The blaze was visible before dawn that morning. Those up early could tell that something big was burning fiercely somewhere out there in the middle of the swamp. But it wasn't burning fast enough or completely enough. When Foster returned, he saw that the frame was still visible. The fire had burned just to the waterline. Foster then put 5 pounds of gunpowder in and around the floating debris, attaching a long fuse, lit it, and got the heck out of there. Loud? Yes, but effective. The ship sank into the thick mud and green, silty muck that only alligators and water moccasins find habitable. Dawn was breaking. Word was already spreading around town. The feds knew they had been fooled, but they were also no closer to finding either the ship or the soon-to-be enslaved. Mayer's plan was to integrate the Africans into the American slave population so that whenever officials came by, none would be the wiser. But that might prove difficult, as the enslaved in Alabama had been in this country for several generations, spoke English, and were typically of Christian faith. Their last names, if they claimed one, were given to them by their owners. They may have borne scars on their backs from whippings, but did not have the tribal identification type of facial scarring present on their African brethren who didn't speak English and did not know, as Casola later told Hurston, that God had a son. Mayer's first order was to forbid them from speaking in their native tongue ever. Others would speak for them and say they were from Virginia or the Carolinas. Truth was, they were living, breathing, standing in the daylight evidence of Mayer's crime. Mayer had first pick. He took 30 for himself, including Casola, whom he renamed Cudjo Lewis. His brothers James and Burns would each get 20 of the others. The rest would be parceled out to other investors. Again, Mobile was alive with news of Mayer's coup. He'd done the impossible and was getting away with it. It didn't take long for word to get around to U.S. authorities based in Mobile. They launched an investigation sometime that July. But no credible, read that, white, witnesses could be found and no evidence unearthed to substantiate the claims. Clark reports in his book that Solomon Barnes, a freed black man who'd worked on re-outfitting the Clotilda, told U.S. Marshals that Foster had paid double wages and had sworn to secrecy those who had labored on the ship. Barnes said he knew what those man-sized shelves were for. Though he asked for protective custody in order to be kept safe while they gathered more evidence, the U.S. attorney, a man named William Jones, balked. Barnes was arrested a few days later on charges of theft. He was sent to prison, and that was that. Captain Foster was supposed to have been questioned. At the very least, the feds knew he likely filed fraudulent custom papers, but he had left for Canada the day before he was due to be called in. Failing at that, federal investigators found First Mate James Smith on August 5th. He asked for immunity and got it. He told everything he knew, from the ship's modifications to the blaze off Point Mobile on the night of their return. But the next day, he was found dead in a jail cell, ostensibly having taken his own life. It is believed the notes from his full confession were destroyed, quite possibly by U.S. Attorney Jones. Jones impaneled a grand jury, which refused to indict anyone. The foreman was said to have owed $12,000 to Mayer and Cotton Futures, and Jones never divulged that his mortgage was held by Mayer. Such were Mobile's societal entanglements. But word got back that the powers in place in Mobile weren't trying hard enough, So U.S. Attorney General Jeremiah Black sent more investigators to Mobile to see what they could find. A man named Marcus Sterling led the charge. In September, he issued this report. Quote, "The evidence of illegal importation of Africans is overwhelming. A conspiracy involving prominent Mobile citizens appears to have successfully landed approximately 100 African slaves in violation of federal law. Local federal authorities appear complicit in covering up the crime. I recommend immediate federal intervention and prosecution." End quote. Clark wrote that before the report could be sent, Sterling was beaten and his notes and any evidence he had of a crime were stolen. Nothing else was taken. A laundress named Mary Welch also came forward. She said she had heard the mayors planning the whole thing. She was found drowned in the Mobile River the next day. The feds then threw up their hands and conceded defeat. Okay, so it was a bit more nuanced than that. According to Clark and other historians, the feds did indict Mayer, his brother Burns, and an associate named John Dabney on charges of illegal possession of the captives. But Mayer and company had deliberately dispersed the hidden Africans in the intervening months. Without their physical presence as evidence and with no ship to even point to, the case was dismissed. Mayer later claimed he had also been charged separately and released on bond, but no contemporaneous records support that. The government did try to charge him with failing to pay dues on his cargo, whatever it was that the missing Clotilda had brought, but he was never prosecuted even for that. Figures, I guess. Alabama left the Union soon after, in January 1861. They didn't give a hoot what the federal government wanted or didn't want. There were bigger fish to fry. But a devoted underling in U.S. Attorney Jones's office named Thaddeus Hammond had been keeping notes. As he was leaving Mobile that winter, he did something his own morality required that he do, as Clark relayed in the Clotilda conspiracy. Quote, "He compiled everything he knew, the destroyed confession, the murdered witnesses, the evidence of conspiracy and cover-up, and sent it to Charles Sumner, the abolitionist senator from Massachusetts. Sumner received the package, but could do nothing with it. War was coming. The crime of the Clotilda was about to be subsumed by the larger crime of the Confederacy itself." End quote. Hammond was heartbroken, primarily because he believed in the law and its ability to right wrongs. He wrote, quote, "The Africans deserve justice. The dead witnesses deserve vindication. America deserves to know how thoroughly its laws failed when powerful men decided they were above them." Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Hims.
ED is way more common than most guys think. Millions deal with it at some point, and that's exactly why Hims offers a straightforward way to handle it.
Right, and it's not exactly a fun thing to talk about with anyone, let alone someone in person, even if that someone's a doctor.
Which is the whole point of Hims. It's 100% online. No awkward appointments, no pharmacy lines. You complete a simple intake, a licensed provider reviews it, and if treatment's right for you, it ships directly to your door in discreet packaging.
That includes Sildenafil, the generic for Viagra, available through Hims at up to 95% less than the brand name.
And if that's not a right fit, there are additional treatment options so you can find what actually works for your body. It's straightforward, transparent, and designed to make getting care feel easy. To get simple online access to personalized, affordable care for ED, weight loss, and more, visit hims.com/COTC. That's hims.com/COTC for your free online visit. hims.com/COTC.
Prescription required. See website for details and important safety information. Sildenafil is the generic version of Viagra. Viagra is a registered trademark of Viatris Specialty LLC. Hims is not affiliated with or endorsed by Viatris. The men, women, and children smuggled aboard the Clotilda were enslaved to the Mobile planter cabal for 5 years. During that time, they were treated much the same as those who had been born here, which of course was itself criminal. According to the National African American Reparations Commission, The transatlantic slave trade brought close to 500,000 Africans directly to U.S. shores. Some 12 million others were trafficked elsewhere, including to South America, primarily Brazil, and to Cuba and the island nations of the Caribbean. As I mentioned earlier, in 1808, a new law banned the importation of enslaved people from Africa, meaning you couldn't bring new captives across the ocean, but it said nothing about the buying, selling, and ownership of people already enslaved on American soil or their children born into slavery. So the domestic slave trade continued completely legally in the U.S., and the enslaved population actually grew significantly after 1808 through natural increase and internal trafficking between states. Banning the import was, in effect, a compromise that let slaveholders keep everything they already had, while allowing abolitionists to at least fake taking a moral stand. 52 years after the importation ban, the enslaved population in the U.S. was close to 4 million when the Clotilda landed on its shores with its illegal cargo. It would prove to be the last slave ship to ever bring Africans directly to the country, and those aboard it were mighty determined to survive. Maybe Mayer knew that, because the Africans unnerved him. In 1863, he ordered them further separated from each other, hoping to mix them in more successfully with the native-born population. It seems he suspected the Africans were still finding a way to talk to each other, even across plantation lines. What exactly was Mayer afraid of? Rebellion from within, perhaps? Maybe that they'd give native-born enslaved people a renewed sense of their right to be free? He knew the Africans held no love for the South, had no families here, and no ties that bound them to the land. But Mayer misunderstood. What the Africans were doing was trying to keep the 93 who had survived together, should the time come to return. They made sure their friends knew where everyone was and that the stories and names that were their heritage were kept alive. That way, they could all go back together when the war was over. The emancipation of the enslaved in Alabama was done, parcel by parcel, as Union soldiers advanced through the South. On April 12, 1865, Montgomery, the capital of Alabama, surrendered to Northern troops. That same day, Mobile surrendered, following the loss of the fortifications at Spanish Fort and Fort Blakely along the shores of Mobile Bay. Almost immediately, Cudjoe Lewis, now in his mid-20s, realized his plan to go home was impossible. There was no way home. He asked for the U.S. government to help, but it had no interest in prosecuting Mayer now, and it had no funds for their passage back. For the Africans, the idea of collecting enough to pay for everyone to make the trip, if any ship was even going that way, was too exorbitant to consider. Not one to accept defeat now, Lewis hit upon another plan. He had not lived 5 years in this country without learning something, and that something? Money talks. Gathering 29 of his fellow shipmates, he urged them to work at whatever wage they could find. Do the hardest stuff, like working on the docks and hauling freight, digging out swampland for the best pay. Do twice as much as anyone else. They would pool their money and feed everyone and save to buy their own land to build their own piece of Africa here. The direction was clear. If your job included travel, you were to ask around about the others in order to bring more under the umbrella of understanding. By July 1865, the little co-op numbered 47. 6 months later, abolitionist missionaries came to Mobile, now intent on empowering those who had been slaves and thus deprived of proper schooling. Lewis made it a point to learn to read and write and level the playing field when dealing with white people. By February of 1867, Lewis had accounted for all 93 people that had shared his trip on the boat. 20 were dead, 52 still lived in or near Mobile, the rest had married into American families and, frankly, had other plans for their lives now. A little less than a year after that, Lewis went to Timothy Mayer and offered to buy 7 acres of swampland that he was anxious to unload. It was not perfect. It was low-lying and mosquito-rich, but if worked, it could grow things. The Africans had most of the $200 needed for purchase and made a deal to pay the rest. Kadjo Lewis explained how that worked to Zora Neale Hurston in 1930. Again, this is an actor reading his words.
"We working hard and save, and eat molasses and bread, and buy the land from the mayor. They don't take off 1 5-cent from the price for us, but we pay it all and take the land."
The idea to recreate Africa within the U.S. was now a reality. The co-op, still pooling their money, built a shelter like the kind they knew in Africa. Employing techniques they remembered, they built it with found wood, plastered it with readily available mud, and shored it up with weaved cane. Then they added two more buildings, established an herbal pharmacy, and divided labor so that everyone shared equally in the bounty, regardless of their job. They created a governing system with rules on everything from alcohol consumption to conflict resolution. They figured out how they would recognize marriage. Children of the community had to learn both English and African languages. They had to hear and retell the stories of how their parents had gotten to Alabama on the Clotilda. While the missionaries had made certain they could fit in and not be treated as illiterate children, but as equal, or equal enough, partners in Mobile life, they had also made it a point to get the Africans to integrate Christianity successfully into their wide-ranging religious traditions. That first summer, they had enough money to buy 12 more acres. They named it all Africa Town. Soon, they bought even more land. They built a church and a cemetery, a sawmill, a brick factory, and enough produce to sell at market. Sylviane Diouf, a visiting scholar at the Center for Slavery and Justice at Brown University, explained to Curiosity Stream that
they were all looked down upon as Africans. And so they took that identity, even though it was a negative thing, you know. It was equivalent to savages and pagans. But they took this identity with pride.
Some in town charged they were socialists. They would counter that they were Africans, living as they had always lived. By 1870, the Africans were in possession of 50 acres of land, had built 15 permanent structures, some of which were family homes, that remain connected to the idea of communal prosperity. When the Ku Klux Klan came to do their worst in 1871, the Africans, who had a kind of neighborhood watch system, were prepared. No stranger to warfare or to dying for their right to exist, everyone in Africa Town was armed and in position. The Klan decided they might not be ready to die just yet, so they went home. Challenged in court now by Timothy Mayer, who claimed their original contract for sale was invalid because the Africans weren't legal citizens, the Africans responded that if Mayer claimed they were Africans, he was admitting his own crime of bringing them here. Touché, said the judge, but in more legal language. The Africans could keep the land they bought fair and square. Emma Langdon Roche, who wrote Historical Sketches of the South in 1914, wrote about Lewis and the founding of Africa Town and included interviews with him about his life, both here and in Africa before his capture. Lewis even drew maps for her of his original village and of the path he had to walk to get to the coast to meet his fate. Anthropologist Hurston showed up in 1928 when only Lewis, who was then about 86, and two others who had come over on the Clotilda were still alive. She was different from a lot of the other journalists who came to see how Africa Town worked. She asked Lewis about his parents, about his life in Africa, about the brutality of the journey here, how he'd survived. She came and stayed, returning frequently to continue conversations on Lewis's porch, to hear not what he had lived through, but how he had, his entire adult life, prayed to go home. In 2018, Smithsonian Magazine told how Hurston asked to take his picture after they'd been talking for 2 months. He put on his best suit but slipped off his shoes, telling her he wanted to look like he was in Africa because that's where he wanted to be. Hurston wrote his story in a book she entitled Barracoon, The Story of the Last Black Cargo. Barracoon is defined as a pen for keeping slaves. In the piece, Hurston introduced Lewis/Casola as, quote, the only man on earth who has in his heart the memory of his African home, the horrors of a slave raid, the barracoon, the Lenten tones of slavery, and who has 67 years of freedom in a foreign land behind him, end quote. In 1931, she shopped her book about Lewis to multiple publishers. When they asked her to alter the way she had quoted him, that is, with the phonetic spelling so that his dialect could read as if you were listening to him, she refused. The times were as daunting as she. The Great Depression had begun, and no one figured the book was worth the risk. It would be almost 90 years before it would see the light of day. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Monsters Among Us. Okay, Scott, have you ever heard a true paranormal story that just sticks with you? Like you wish you could unhear it, but you can't?
You know I love paranormal stories. That's my first pick most movie nights. And I like it in podcast form, too. The whole premise of Monsters Among Us is that every week, real people call in and share their actual encounters with the unexplained.
Ghouls, strange creatures, missing time, things that genuinely don't make sense.
It's just so cool that you're hearing these stories in the witnesses' own voices. So it feels a little too real.
There's one about a woman who drove past a fatal car accident and realized she had picked up a ghostly hitchhiker, the actual victim, and another caller who saw three entities moving in unison in the woods, then lost 8 hours with zero explanation.
What? The show is hosted by Derek Hayes, and it's got that classic Unsolved Mysteries energy mixed with the eerie storytelling style of Art Bell. There are over 500 episodes already, so if you are even a little curious about the paranormal, that's a serious rabbit hole to fall into.
So go check out Monsters Among Us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. As the 20th century banged on, Africa Town morphed with it, growing to be about 12,000 strong. A real town complete with a post office and gas station, grocery store, and a bevy of hardworking people who didn't have to leave the enclave to have everything they needed. All of those who had real memories of a life across the ocean were dead by the 1940s. Their families fractured for all the reasons families do. To pursue better work elsewhere, or to follow their own dreams or the dreams of those they married. The Second World War took some of their number to places they had never seen. The world had gotten bigger. But the story inside Africatown stayed the same. Lorna Gale Woods, a descendant of Charlie and Maggie Lewis, no relation to Cudjo, told National Geographic that,
"My grandmama, she was the one that instilled in me about history. Charlie that came over on the Clotilda, that was my great-great-grandfather. He was the head of the Taka tribe. They were hunting for food, but while they was on their way back to the camp, people were out hunting for people that they captured to take back or bring to America for slave."
This is Miss Woods again, talking to the producers of the Netflix documentary Descendant.
"Our family came from another continent and came to Mobile, started their own little town, bought land, and it's still in the family. And they told us never to give up the land, because they found out that having land gave you a voice here in Mobile, Alabama. My grandmama at night, she'd sit by the fireplace and tell her stories, passing it down so we could tell the story the way they would have told them. Now they call me the treasure keeper in my family. I take the role in trying to keep the history alive by telling the story to whoever listens."
Woods, as well as a few other of the descendants, still live on the original site, which is, by now, no longer isolated farmland, but something else entirely. Environmental activist Ramsey Sprague.
Africatown is completely surrounded every direction by some form of heavy industry.
There was a PCB manufacturer in Africatown. There was a lead smelter in Africatown. There was a DOD hazardous waste dump in Africatown. Then you had International Paper Company. You have waves of chemical refineries related to the paper industry and now the oil industry.
It became a sad outpost just north of Mobile, beset by nearby industrial development. And no surprise, its residents reported having unusually high rates of cancer, though no localized cancer data had been officially collected. In the spring of 2017, some 1,200 of its residents sued International Paper for its release of dioxin into the surrounding soil. The company denied the allegations. A partial settlement was made, with plaintiffs reportedly having received as little as $200 each. Most of the white population of Mobile never chanced upon Africatown and hadn't been told the story of its origins. If they had, they had reason to doubt the story was true. After all, it was simply a story told by a few dozen people who hadn't originally spoken much English. Nothing confirmed the tale. Some had tried to find remnants of the Clotilda among the nooks and crannies of Mobile Bay, but they had all come up empty. Even historians had questioned its veracity. In early 2018, Ben Rains, an environmental reporter for AL.com, wanted to see if he could make any headway. He dug out comments Captain Foster had made to a newspaper in 1890 about where on the river he had torched the ship. Word was he'd been drunk while he was doing the talking, but he had thrown out a few names of the bay's landmarks. Rains figured, what the heck? After all, the boat couldn't simply have disappeared. It had been 86 feet long and 23 feet wide. But the waters of the river were as vicious and as opaque as chocolate milk. Rains, an experienced boater and licensed charter captain, set out to do what countless others had failed to. He'd made a few forays into Bayou Canoe and once even alerted authorities to a find, which turned out not to be the Clotilda. It was too new. The reporter wasn't deterred. Again and again, he went searching for the lost ship. On January 21st, 2019, 11 months into his search, he found submerged planking, most of it charred and baked hard, along with iron fasteners and stakes where chains would have been attached. He measured the wreckage, and the dimensions matched. Rain's find would have to be authenticated by archaeologists and historians, but he knew in his heart he had found it. In May 2019, 159 years after the ship's final journey, the Alabama Historical Commission confirmed it. The Clotilda was still lying in the muck and mire of the bayou bed. The dimensions of it, and of the prison-like hold where 100 or so had been herded for the voyage, was even smaller than expected. Clark, the author, described it as, quote, less than the size of a modern shipping container, end quote. About 70% of the ship is still there. According to AL.com and National Geographic, the search has now turned to finding human DNA that may be leached into the wood where it's since been locked inside. The area around the ship is now more or less a crime scene and has been given a special status for ongoing historical research. The jury is still out on whether moving the ship from the water and mud would cause more rapid deterioration than keeping it in its current state. To be clear, the structure will deteriorate either way. On June 20th, 2019, the Mayer family issued a statement that acknowledged what their ancestor had done and indicated that, quote, we recognize the pain this history has caused, end quote. When Anderson Cooper talked to the descendants of the Clotilda captives for a 60 Minutes segment in November 2020, it was clear they wanted more than recognition.
And they'd like the descendants of Timothy Mayer, the man who enslaved their ancestors, to get involved. According to tax records, Mayer's descendants still own an estimated 14% of the land in historic Africatown. Their name is on nearby street signs and property markers. Court filings indicate their real estate and timber businesses are worth an estimated $36 million.
The
But so far, the descendants we spoke with say no one from the Mayer family has been willing to meet.
That changed in 2023 after Helen Mayer, an attorney, began to volunteer at the Africatown Food Bank. She and her sister, Meg, an accountant who had recently accepted the reins of her family's company, met with the descendants. For that, Anderson Cooper went back to Mobile. This is Meg, Timothy's great-great-granddaughter.
We were silent for far too long, and we were distant for far too long. And we're very happy to be able to finally break the silence and to narrow the distance.
With the finding of the ship, historians have nailed down more specifics. For the culturally hip, they confirm that Amir Kalib Thompson, better known as Questlove, the drummer of The Roots, the house band of The Tonight Show, descended from Charlie and Maggie Lewis, who had been brought here directly from Africa. Now, whenever there's a story like this one, one that highlights the ugliness of America's past, there always seems to be naysayers, no matter what evidence is presented to them. I'll probably get a few emails of the sort. On July 19th, 2024, Eric Colonius, an author and former journalist, wrote in the Wall Street Journal that the whole story of the Clotilda was a hoax. He maintains that the Africans came to Mobile in 1858 on the Wanderer, the subject of his own book. Colonius argues that the Clotilda story began as a Civil War-era prank by pro-slavery Southerners meant to embarrass the federal government and gradually hardened from folklore into accepted history. His evidence? No trial records exist at the National Archives, despite an 1890 account describing a dramatic courtroom proceeding. Mobile's own newspaper at the time called the whole thing a fabrication, and the archaeological team that identified the wreck acknowledged they found no single artifact that definitively tied it to the Clotilda. He theorizes that Africatown's founders weren't Clotilda survivors at all, but wanderer captives who had been trafficked west from Georgia into Alabama. But that's discounting Kasolo himself, aka Kudjo Lewis, who described the voyage in detail to Hurston decades before anyone stood to gain anything from the story being true. Most everyone, historians, archaeologists, academics, officials, has dismissed Colonius. Vita Robbins, a descendant of Polly Allen, one of those brought here on the Clotilda, told Mobile's NBC 15 she finds the claim ridiculous.
We should just ignore claims like this because, like I said, we've been here before. Our whole history has been claimed to not be true, that how we got here, it was claimed that it never happened. So we didn't believe it generations ago, and we still don't believe it now. We know what we know is true, and we're not concerned about the naysayers.
That she even has to say this is mind-boggling. Do you know how many old cases I've covered where the trial info was lost in a flood or a courthouse fire? And those were going back just 30 or 40 years. This one dates back a century and a half, plus it was right around the time of an all-consuming civil war. We've got a good bit of contemporaneous evidence that this thing really happened, including the word of those aboard the ship. But for the sake of argument, let's set that aside a moment. In 1892, when Alabama's Bridgeport News Herald reported on Timothy Mayer's death, it identified him as the importer of the, quote, last cargo of slaves brought into the United States, end quote. 2 years before that, Mayer himself outlined to a newspaper reporter his part in the chartering of the ship, paying $35,000 in 1860 gold and supplying $9,000 to Captain Foster for the purchase of the Africans he came home with. The newspaper story also explained how Mayer had crafted an alibi for his own whereabouts that covered the time from the Clotilda's arrival in Mobile Bay through the time of the transfer of the slaves to land through the scuttling of the ship. Mayer's own descendants don't buy that it was a hoax. I'd take their word for it, if I hadn't already taken Kudjo Lewis's word for it. That Timothy Mayer felt no compunction about confessing during the so-called redemption era speaks to his lack of fear of reprisal or accountability for his crime. His descendants appear to be trying to make amends, if not full reparation, and that would be a monumental task. But they moved to remove the street signs in Africatown and on regional maps that bore the family's name. It's a start. To research this case, journalist Amy Wilson read The Clotilda Conspiracy, America's Last Slave Ship and the Secret That Survived by Matthew Harrison Clark. She also read Zora Neale Hurston's Barracoon, The Story of the Last Black Cargo, as well as Jeffrey K. Side's The Echoes of the Clotilda. She read Ben Rain's account of his finding of the vessel in AL.com and other related pieces in the New York Times, National Geographic, and the Smithsonian Magazine. Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grabbag Collab. Head to www.grabbagcollab.com for exclusive content related to this show and access to other series on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this case was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Henry Lavoie. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and sometimes my child, Hunt Van Benskoten. Other music comes from Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, please help us out by rating and reviewing on Apple Podcasts. Also, tell your friends. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com. On Instagram, we're @centuriespod, and you can find us on the Crimes of the Centuries Facebook page.